You're listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast for corporate real estate and workplace leaders, where we talk about all things workplace and invite the people who are shaping the next generation of the office experience. I'm your host, Raphael Morgulis. In today's episode, I'm speaking to Daniel Strode. Daniel is the author of The Culture Advantage. Truth be told, I have never met Dan. Actually, it was one of my colleagues that met him at a conference in Madrid and that came back to the office and said, oh, Raphael, you have to talk to Dan. This is such an interesting person to talk to. And so, of course, I reached out to Dan and he was very, very, very kind to join us here on The Workplace Leader. So hello, Dan. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Today is Wednesday, the 14th of December. Getting close to Christmas and very excited.
So I want to start off by setting a little bit the stage about you. So can you tell us a little bit what your role is, what your background is?
Sure. So I'm maybe not a unique person, but definitely an unusual person in the sense that I am part culture practitioner, so head of culture at Banco Santander, one of the biggest banks in the world, part teacher and academic, teaching at various business schools around the world. And now, as you say, a third part added to the bow, which is part author as well, having written The Culture Advantage that was recently released. So I tend to say that I look at culture from many different angles and lenses. Basically, the last 5 or 6 years of my life has just been dedicated to finding out and researching what are the most innovative cultural companies doing around the world.
So that was going to be my next question. You have this book that came out, The Culture Advantage. What does it exactly mean, The Culture Advantage? How can you summarize that in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, probably quite difficult, but I would say the pace of change in the world is not slowing down. It's never been so fast, but never will it be so slow in the future. And what this means is that companies need to change, need to adapt. Otherwise, they face the very, very real risk of going out of business. And what I've observed is it doesn't really matter how much money you have, what structure you have, what strategy you have to say whether you'll be successful in the future. It's more related to the culture and the environment that you've built within the companies. So that really is the culture advantage, I would say, perhaps in a nutshell.
That is actually quite fascinating to me because you speak about innovation and the need for change and the need for innovation for companies to almost survive. And you come from a position in a very large financial institution. I think me, I'm working in a startup. Innovation in a startup is necessary. Without it, the startup doesn't actually get off the ground. But when you're in a large financial institution, how does innovation work?
I mean, the first thing to say is it really does not matter what size of company you have, and it doesn't matter what resources you have either to say whether you can or cannot innovate. So that's, of course, one of the challenges, which is to say a large company has different challenges from a small company because perhaps you're less agile, you're less nimble, but you have advantages as well because you may have more people, more knowledge, more partnerships, and so on and so forth. But I would say what you need is you need to have the mindset for innovation. And especially with the large companies, the key differences or the key distinction is, do we want to change? And what are we willing to give up now to plan for the future? And that's always very difficult for large companies because typically they have their cash cow and their existing business, and they don't want to deviate from the BAU because it's making them money today. But you need to do that. Otherwise, Kodak being the wonderful example, you fall by the wayside. You know, Kodak is the example, the business example, and the case study taught around the world about a company that designed and developed the first digital camera, but didn't want to take the risk of cannibalizing and eating their existing business, which was printing pieces of paper. That, of course, came to bite them later down the line. So I think having that mentality and willingness to innovate, but then also execute, is really critical.
it sounds very big objectives, big picture when it comes to the company. Then if we go down, let's say, to more specifics, so for example, certain elements of the business, so you are responsible more on the human resources side of things, our target audience at Locati and our audience here for this podcast is more related to the workplace and corporate real estate. Innovation within business units, is there any pitfall? Is there any difficulty? So for example, you mentioned Kodak, that's more business model, right? At the scale of the entire company. When it comes to more functions, how is there anything that you can tell here?
Yeah, one of the things I always love to do with functional innovation or innovation within a business specific to a certain segment or silo is to say, do we really have a growth mindset or do we have a fixed mindset? So there's typically two types of people. There's people who have a fixed mindset who believe that they don't need to change. They don't want to take risk. They're protecting their back all of the time. If it's not broken, there's no need to touch it. And then you have people with this growth mindset, which is, I want to try new things. I want to learn. Feedback is an opportunity to grow and develop. And the good news is we can teach that kind of growth mindset within businesses. And that's one of the things we have to do, because if we want to innovate, we need people taking risks and trying new things. So when I look at specific functions, I typically ask managers, do you have an environment where people can thrive, where they can grow, where they can learn, where they can take risks? And some of the things I like to get them doing is I like them to set objectives which are not only related to the business. So, for example, maybe your typical objectives in property management would be build a new building, reduce the electricity consumption, those kind of things. But how many people took the time to set a personal objective related to their development or their learning of something new? And if you do that, what you tend to find is you tend to find this kind of cross-pollination happens. People take on new ideas from different teams, different areas, and they bring it back to their functional area and then start to change things based on what they've learned, what they've seen. So that's just one hint and tip that always comes to the front of my mind when thinking about this.
Thanks. And one of the things that we hear a lot when it comes to the office and culture is that a lot of companies or leaders are saying, okay, the office is such a strong driver, a strong piece of the organization culture puzzle, kind of, and that it has a lot to do with creating personal interactions, that face-to-face interactions are crucial to create culture. At the same time, I think we can safely say that face-to-face is not an absolute necessity to create a group culture, because we have now a couple of decades of internet communities to tell us that this is not necessarily absolutely necessary. What would be the pitch to say we need to have face-to-face interaction in order to enhance the culture and to create a better, let's say, foundation for example, innovation culture and more risk-taking?
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy the typical idea, which is you need to come to the office to collide with people over the vending machine and then suddenly come up with ideas. So this doesn't happen. You know, if you sit on a floor with human resources professionals, maybe you bump into the people the same every single day. But if I wanted to speak to someone in marketing, I will have to go to another floor, another building to do that. Well, actually, the internet gives me the advantage, which is I can have an online community just like that. So, you know, you're seeing things like Web3 happening now, and very strong communities are being built. But the research shows and proves that in-person events are absolutely necessary to reinforcing and strengthening those bonds. And one of the things is, if you have, you need to have psychological safety in a company to really let people thrive. And I think that can only be built by having face-to-face relations. Why do I say that? Because psychological safety is basically creating an environment where people can participate, where they can speak up, when they're feeling free to share things. Well, doing that online is not so easy. But when you meet face-to-face and you can talk about your family, your work, your relationships, your hobbies, you can see people, you can look them in the eye, you can touch them, you can do team-building activities, so on and so forth, you generally foster that sense of community in a more intimate and faster and deeper way. So for me, I love the idea of hybrid work, and I love to take the advantages of Web3 or digital communication technology in the sense of I can reach more people, which is great, or people specific to my agenda, but I must have that face-to-face interaction to reinforce those bonds. And if I look at what do I do in my day-to-day, of course, my role is global, and I bring people from all of the countries to come as one group together and meet face-to-face. And it is most of the time spent doing the team building, doing the bonding, getting to know each other, building those relationships just on that deeper level.
This is fascinating because I think you mentioned so many different points that are kind of crucial here. So one of the things you said, for example, you need to, in order for, let's say, innovation and diversity of ideas come up, you need to meet different types of people. And that's not something that you will get just by going to your regular office. At the same time, I heard a presentation a couple of weeks ago, how when COVID hit and everyone went to work from home, statistics of interactions in certain systems showed that the average networks of people shrunk completely, that people used to be talking or networking with, I don't know, 50 to 80 people on an average. And then with COVID, it shrunk to half of that. So that's a very strong pitch for the office, because on one side, you need to create these kind of networks and connection in the organization. And like you said, you need to also create this kind of bond, which cannot be really done or is not so easily done online. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think one of the other interesting things is also around the topic, you know, very, very important, which is mental well-being and health of the employees. And again, you have those studies that show, and we know through COVID that people faced, of course, more mental well-being challenges. And I don't only put it down to the fact that they were not necessarily in the office because there was a pandemic going on and everyone was impacted, but that's definitely a key driver. And we know that having those social interactions help boost people's well-being. So we have a role to play in that as well. We have a role and a responsibility to make sure the employees are happy and content and healthy. And that can be one of the tactics or one of the use cases as well for the office, I think.
And what can either, for example, a human resource team or leadership, I don't know, what can a company, an organization do to foster the kind of diversity of interactions? Because I think it's very easy to say, okay, we need to get back to the office 3 or 4 or 5 days a week, but then everyone comes and goes to their normal office and doesn't really meet anyone and nothing really happens. So what could be done in order to actually foster kind of diversity of meetings and create this kind of more diverse network?
Yeah, I mean, because that's the worst thing. You walk into some offices around the world and you see the people doing Zoom calls all day long and you say, nothing has changed. What's going on here? So, you know, in the Spanish culture where I'm based, of course, the lunchtime is a very big social event. It's an event that can span 1 hour, maybe even 2 hours, rather than if you look to the UK where you typically pick a sandwich and eat it on your desk. So depending the culture of the country, obviously you have some opportunities there. But I think always getting together as teams, having regular team meetings face to face, having town halls where you have the opportunity to hear from external speakers or speakers from outside of your division or department, they're always really, really beneficial. And what I've seen in some companies doing very successful is doing things like family days. So bringing the family to the office, really starting to do more social bonding activities. So as I say, the office perhaps nowadays isn't the place to do deep work. If you need to do that, maybe you're better suited to doing that in the home office. And when you don't need to do the deep work or where you do want to have that social experience, then you should come to the office. But it does require that we change the rules within the companies and make it very clear, what do we expect of people when they come to the office? You know, there was one company that I was speaking to that even puts the out of office message on people's emails when they're in the office. And the message reads, I'm really sorry, today I'm in the office, which means I'm probably speaking to people face to face. So I'm going to reply to your email with a delay. And by the way, if you want to find me, come and find me on the second floor, desk number 10. And I thought that was a really, really good example of a company saying, this is what we want to use the office for. And the rules of engagement are super clear.
And then I suppose the other step is to bring that and the office, how the layout of the office together. Because as far as I remember, none of the offices I've ever worked in was tailored for these kind of things. So, for example, bringing families or any other type of activities that would encourage that. So that kind of calls for not just talking about the employee experience from a network point of view, but then also, okay, where does it happen and what's the best way to have a room or a space for this to happen?
And this is really important because one of the main contributing factors when you're trying to change or embed a culture is physical symbols that you can see. So for example, does your chief executive officer have a parking spot closest to the office and your frontline employee furthest away from the office? Okay, it's not for me to say what's right or wrong here, but that is a symbol that people can see in the office about who is important and so on and so forth. If you have a space for families, a space for customers to visit you, if you have, you know, facilities that are really geared around the customer or the product, then again, you're saying this is what we expect. So if you want a culture of innovation and you want people to have conversations together and co-create and so on, well, does it not make more sense to have those agile ways of working spaces rather than, well, I don't know how to say it, 20th century office cubicles? We should lead by example. We should try to change those symbols that we see in the office and the expectations that then become very clear for people.
It reminds me of a previous conversation I had on another episode. Someone from Ernst & Young was saying, at the end, we need to tie this to the company objectives. And like you said at the beginning, innovation needs to be at the heart of how the company functions. Because if this is then not, let's say, meaningful and not tied to a real intent of the company to put innovation in its core functioning, then it's going to be perceived as maybe, let's say, for image mostly, and not necessarily something that the people need to live.
And this is really important. I always define culture as the way we do things around here when no one is looking. And that when no one is looking is really, really important and critical, because you can't expect culture to be successful if you're doing it just because you want to look good and have something nice on your wall. You have to do it because you really believe in it and you've really bought into it. And that's exactly your point, which is if you just do it because you want to be the best or look like you're first in the rankings, then for sure it's going to be doomed to failure.
Speaking about being first in rankings, I thought you had a very interesting take around hybrid teams needing to look more at how sports teams operate. And now we're seeing, for example, the World Cup happening. And I think national teams are even more extreme example of that. So they're the best players in the nation. They don't necessarily play together all year long. They're not in the same team every day. And we know that the teams that won the whole thing are usually the teams that found a way to function better as a group, not necessarily because they have the best individuals. And if we're relating that again to the work environment, it sounds a lot like, okay, the priority is the group, is the community, is kind of belonging together, having a similar objective and bonding around this, rather than, okay, who has the best skills and how do I accumulate skills? Question is, are organizations doing that already? Or and able to prioritize that in recruiting, for example?
It's a great question. And there are two types of companies. So there's ones that are doing it and ones that aren't doing it. And it's really interesting because two things on my mind. The first is the role of the leader. The role of the leader in good cultures, positive cultures, and, you know, innovative cultures is to help support the team. Is not to look the best and have the achievements for themselves. And if you look at sports teams and you look at the World Cup, I can assure you that when the trophy is lifted, let me say by Argentina, it will be the players that lift the trophy first, not the coach. And the coach is there to support the players. But in some companies, it's the other way around. In some companies, the leader is trying to gain the limelight, take the advantage, take credit for all of the work the team has done, so on and so forth. And that, of course, is a bit of a toxic culture, not conducive to success. And the second thing is, when you're hiring people, it's very important when you think about culture that you hire people who add value to your culture. And that means they are team players rather than what I call a brilliant jerk, which is perhaps a salesperson that can sell more but is horrible to the team and creates a toxic culture. Because what that does is, even though that person is selling more, you have other people selling less because they're unhappy at work, they leave, there's more rotation, so on and so forth, all bad things for the company. It's much, much better to have strong team players, people who are working together, care about one another, and you will have better results. And we've seen that time and time again. And the sports analogy is exactly that. There's not one world superstar who can carry a team that's dysfunctional and not talking to each other and not wanting to pass to each other because I'm the best player and so on and so forth. But if you look at Morocco now, I would hazard a guess and say they're in the semifinals of the World Cup. They're not necessarily the best team pound for pound in terms of skill and ability. But what they do have is they have an unbelievable strong bond. And you can see that because when they celebrate at the end of the games, they bring their parents onto the pitch. I've never seen that before. I mean, isn't that showing like a level of humility and gratefulness and thankfulness? I'm sure that is helping them progress.
That is such a great image and symbol. At the same time, I want to take that discussion and that argumentation and kind of play devil's advocate and say, okay, we're talking a lot these days about culture, about employee experience, all these kind of intangibles that we say go a long way to predict business outcomes. But what if leadership's deeper feelings on this is something like, hey, okay, sure, that's nice, but we just went through a pandemic and then the world kind of stopped in its tracks and now we have an economic downturn. So, you know, we have more important things to deal with. Right now, we have to protect the business perspectives, or let's say the very, very immediate bottom line elements. And we don't have the time, or we cannot be distracted by these nice to have elements. How would you respond and address that if you were faced with such an attitude?
I mean, it's very difficult in these cases because this is clearly a case of thinking in the short term. And actually, I understand that industry and the stock market and everything drives that short-term thinking. And as a CEO, you're under a lot of pressure to, you know, hit short-term results, and you don't necessarily have that eye to the future. But the reality is, if you look at the S&P 500, so the top 500 firms in America by market capitalization, 75% of them will not be in that index in 5 years' time, according to the historical data. So 2027, 75% of the S&P 500 will be changed. If you name me the 10 companies that come to your mind first and then think that 7 or 8 of them won't be so big in the future, that's quite shocking. And I think it's now incumbent upon us as professionals teaching culture to say, this is a business imperative. You simply must do this. And here's the weight of evidence to support it. And now we're lucky because people have been talking about culture for hundreds of years, but in the last 10 years, very intensely when it comes to business. And there have been wonderful studies in the past few years by McKinsey and other major consultancies, which have proved the link between profitability and culture. So finally, we have a little bit more tangible data to be able to go into a boardroom and say, look, this is important.
This is making me think of the sports image again, because you mentioned how the CEO needs to think about the short-term results and 5 years or 10 years down the line to protect the business. Interestingly, in sports, you have two different people for that. You have the coach who tends to be one, let's say, worrying about the next game or the current season. And then you have the general manager who tends to be thinking more, okay, one season to 5 seasons. We don't really have that in business, do we? Or everything is on the shoulder of the CEO.
Yeah, that's true. It's not quite the same structure, is it? And, you know, actually, it's interesting because the reality is you need that general manager view. You need that CEO view to the extent that, you know, you need a long-term thinking. You need someone thinking about the strategy. And of course, you need someone executing that strategy. And maybe it's not the role of the CEO to do the execution of the strategy. Maybe that has to be someone else. But it is their role, the culture and the long-term vision. Because when they don't do that, no one in the company will believe it. If you don't have the number one person in charge of your company fully committed to culture, it will be doomed to failure. And that's perhaps one of the biggest mistakes that I see. I see people outsource culture and say, yeah, give that to human resources or give it to marketing or communications, and it doesn't work. people don't buy it because they know you're not invested in that yourself.
Right. That leads me to a bit of an out-of-the-box question. What is the most creative or experimental thing that you've done yourself in the workplace environment, in the culture environment so far in your career?
Oof, what a question. Probably two things come to my mind. I love doing social media challenges, so because they build like team spirit, everybody can be involved in that. They're not costly, you know, these are things that anyone can participate in. And we've done a few of them, and one that comes to my mind was the 10 press-ups challenge. So we had people across the organization recording themselves doing 10 press-ups. And I actually did my 10 press-ups with a very large Lego block on my back. It was lighter than it looked, so the video looked quite impressive. But that's one that sticks in my mind. But I think they're good for team building and so on. The second thing that comes to my mind is we actually recorded a video to attract new talent into the organization. And it was called the Healthiest Company video. And it was a real video because we took people to interview with us, but we took them to the gym, we took them to a cafe, we took them to a school, we took them to a park and did the interview there. And they were saying, well, why am I doing an interview here and not in an office? We said, well, this is because we place a large value on health and well-being. We place a value on your personal life with your children. We place a value on going to the gym and being healthy and having time to do that. And it was quite interesting to see the virality of that and, you know, how that could actually position the company in a different way than come for an interview with a suit and tie on in an office. So that was something fun that I look back with a smile on.
That sounds pretty good. Can you also think of something, so an idea, an experiment, something that you've seen that made you very jealous because you thought, oh, I would have wanted to have thought about this first?
Oof, this is a hard one. I mean, I wish I invented the iPhone and so on and so forth. But really, I'm more inspired, and my work is about being inspired by best practices across the world. And, you know, I'm not necessarily wanting to be first in any topic or jealous of any topic. But what I do like to do is I love to learn. So having that growth mindset, and then I'm happy to replicate or adapt what we learn, what we see, and take that forwards. And I think, honestly, many successful people and companies are doing that. They're constantly scanning the market, trying to sense what's going on, and then being willing to adapt. So not necessarily copy or have regret that I wasn't first on something.
Okay, last question from me. Who do you think we should be inviting to this podcast next?
Great question. I think there's a guy, Dr. Stephen McGregor, who I really, really love. He's very expert on health and well-being and leadership, but he's very interesting profile because he comes from a design background as well. And I know he has a lot of experience in you know, offices and layouts and environments. And I think that could be an interesting discussion to have. What kind of environment do you need to have great leadership and so on? So that's my recommendation.
Thank you. I think it's interesting because often when we ask these for these recommendations, we get profiles that are usually not just one type of background. It's multiple kind of experiences. And we see how having this kind of diversity of experience and journey creates a lot of, let's say, new, interesting arguments or takes. And that's something to take away as well from a cultural point of view. You need to have diversity, not just in one person, but in a team, in a group, in order to create new different types of answers.
Absolutely. And I think one of the best things companies can do when it comes to what you've just described is start thinking about talent marketplaces, job swaps, job shares, short-term assignments. How can you move people from one team to another so that they learn new skills or exposed to new ideas? And then they take that back to their previous role or even move to a new role. The more movement you can get around the organization, the better it is for the person and the company. So we need to do that. We need not to think in the old way, which is one career path, one company, move up the career ladder step by step. The world has changed.
That's really interesting. Thanks a lot, Dan. That was a very, very interesting conversation. And I know there's a lot of takeaways for our listeners. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking with you.
I really connected with a number of notions that Daniel is presenting, and I really connected with the parallels he draws with sports teams when it comes to culture. In a number of conversations I've been having on the workplace, on employee experience and company culture, the notion of leadership keeps coming to the forefront. There is no question that leadership is a crucial piece of the workplace puzzle. And when it comes to leadership, sports is an incredibly great way to learn about leadership, maybe even a better way than the corporate world. Why? Because sports teams are incredibly fluid. If you think, for example, about France's national team, from one key competition like the 2021 Euro to the 22 World Cup 1 year later, more than half of the team had changed. The competition is ferocious for national teams. None of the players called up has a contract with the national team. And then the timelines are extremely compressed. In a few weeks, the group that has been selected needs to come together, find out how to work together, establish a strategy and execute, and usually with the whole world watching. In that case, leadership isn't a feature, it just becomes a natural requirement for success. And therefore, it was fascinating to me to see a very specific learning on leadership happening at the recent World Cup. Lionel Messi is, by all accounts, a pretty quiet personality. He's maybe the exact opposite of, let's say, the barking leader that we regularly see highlighted in American sports, for example. He's quiet, he's focused, and for years in Barcelona and in the Argentinian national team, he was relying on senior figures to do the leading with their voices. His former national coach called him a silent leader, meaning one that would lead more by example than with his voice. But actually, in the last few years, Messi has changed. We've seen him taking more of a center vocal role with Argentina especially, something he probably would never have done 10 or even 5 years prior, even though back then he was already and by far the best and most influential player on his teams. But Messi has gradually grown into this more complete version of his leadership, and it's taken him time to learn this aspect of his role. Of course, me being French, I was clearly heartbroken by the outcome of the 22 World Cup final. But at the same time, it was a joy for me to see Lionel Messi, one of the most famous introverted role models in my lifetime, showing to the entire world that it is possible to gradually grow vocal leadership skills and use them to achieve the ultimate team objective. Thanks for listening. We will soon be back for more. And in the meantime, go visit our blog at Loqueti.com and have a look at the other topics we have covered, or stay tuned for more episodes of The Workplace Leader.